This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, everybody.
As we said, this is a bonus episode of the Asian Cinema Film Club, and the reason we're obviously coming here outside of our usual recording schedule is because the BBC have recently put together a list of what they and the 209 critics in 43 countries, they polled them to ask for what was the 100 greatest foreign language films of all time. And, you know, obviously this was one that you brought to my attention, Stephen, because, I mean, you thought it would be something that would be fun to obviously discuss here on the show. And especially because when we looked at this list, I think we had, it was pretty clear, anyone who follows our Facebook page would know that we had some pretty open opinions on what we thought of their list and certainly their picks. And we're obviously going to go through the Asian cinema side because, I mean, it's going to take forever to go through 100 films. So we're just obviously going to be talking about the Asian cinema side of the list tonight. But, yes, yeah, I mean, what was your sort of initial thoughts on this list?
Well, when I first saw it, I thought, well, that's fascinating. And I looked at the list in the whole and it's just, I think the word's obvious, but for those sort of lists, yeah. You know. And then it was interesting. Then it said some interesting stuff, like 25 of the films they said were from Asia. And by Asia, they mean Japan, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and one from South Korea. So basically our patch, yeah. And although I knew exactly the films, about half of them I could have named without even looking, I was surprised at a lot of the list, a lot of what was missing, but I wasn't surprised. I mean, the top 10 films, four of them are Asian. The top three films, or the top four films, three of the top four are Asian films.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think, you know, foreign language also meant French cinema, German cinema, Spanish cinema, South American cinema, you know, I think that's quite an interesting bias towards Asian cinema, and therefore was worth having a talk about.
Yeah, I mean, obviously when we're looking at this, and I think whenever they do a critics poll, it seems that they always kind of play it a little safe. And I think this has been, as we're obviously, when we get into this in a minute, with a lot of these sort of titles, it's sort of like, oh, these are like a bunch of sort of safe titles, and there's a lot of art house stuff here. So I think a lot of the things that if we were to obviously poll amongst sort of our friends and people we consider to be fans of Asian cinema, I think the list would be a lot different of what would obviously be appearing here. And obviously as we get into it, we'd obviously, I think it'd become a bit more sort of clear the direction that I think a lot of these critics were going on their list. But, I mean, where should we obviously start with this one then?
Well, what I was going to do is I've extracted the 25, okay. And maybe we'll just go down. Yeah. I suspect there's a few films we can't talk about because neither of us will have seen them, because it's that kind of list. So shall I just open it up? Number 98, Pop Pickers, was In the Heat of the Sun, a Chinese film by Zhang Wen from 1994, which I've got to confess, I've never seen.
No, me and myself neither. so that's one for the Cinema Shameless right off the bat.
Indeed. Following up at number 95 is Floating Clouds, a Japanese film by Mikio Naruse from 1955, which I've never seen.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a fair amount of cinema shame here. So, but yeah, I mean, obviously knowing Naruse's work, I mean, this is again very sort of art house around this sort of time, and obviously being 50s cinema, I mean, there are just more interesting directors obviously working in this sort of period, but.
Okay, don't worry, because at number 93 is Raise the Red Lantern by Zhang Yimou. What year is that? 1991. I have seen that. Also, I've seen a lot of Zhang Yimou's films. However, these aren't the films that possibly most of our audience would know him for. I think there's a couple of films on the list. Because I suspect our audience will know him for Hero and House of the Flying Daggers. Yeah. And more recently, disastrous monster film starring Matt Damon. But he is he's an important Chinese director. What's he called? Is he the Fifth Wave or something? They have some... Everything in China seems to have a number associated to it. But, you know, and I think he designed the 2008 Beijing Olympic opening and closing ceremony. So this is a relatively big deal director. This is a pretty good film, very beautiful. Who's in it? And it's one of the films with Gong Li in it. And I think we've spoken about Gong Li before, who's probably the sort of the big crossover girl, isn't she, between art house Chinese and Western cinema.
Yeah, definitely Gong Li is that sort of go-between the two. I think certainly as a director, I think for a lot of people, as you rightfully said, I think it's sort of around 2002 that he sort of really comes to the attention, especially for audiences of the West, if you're not part of that art house sort of crowd. Here in 2002 really sort of gets someone's attention. And I think this is really thanks a lot in part to Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because when we obviously look at Hero, it's very easy to compare the two. Obviously, Hero, a lot more sort of artistic in style. We've obviously got the different colour representations for the different stories there, and it was the first point in a really nice trilogy of films, obviously following up with House of Flying Daggers and Curse of the Golden Flower, which is very cruelly overlooked. I think that after House of Flying Daggers, I think a lot of people weren't on board for another round of art house kung fu from the director, and they kind of missed out. And it's a shame, really, because Curse of the Golden Flower is sort of like the most traditional sort of martial arts picture you could really sort of get. Obviously, from there, I mean, he obviously goes on to do things such as, like, again, very underrated The Flowers of War with Christian Bale, and more recently, he's obviously done The Great Wall, which people got so caught up in the diversity and casting choices of that movie that I don't think anybody actually watched it. So, but yeah, I would agree he's certainly an important director. Raise the Red Lantern.
I was just surprised that Hero wasn't on here, but maybe you're right. Maybe that film came into the consciousness on the coattails of another film on this list, and maybe that's why it's not thought of. So, at number 88, we have The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum by Kenji Mizoguchi from 1939. I've never seen any Kenji Mizoguchi films. There's a couple on this list, so I have nothing to say. 1939 Japanese film isn't really going to appear on my radar.
We don't get a lot of early sort of Japanese movies. I mean, it's hard enough to get sort of early cinema for like American cinema and even sort of like the German expressionistic sort of films, like the Fritz Lang movies, unless they've obviously had some sort of cult appeal or sort of critical importance, you don't tend to see a lot of these early sort of cinema films. And it's kind of frustrating now, but obviously now we're moving more into streaming and away from physical media, that you kind of get the feeling that these are going to be the sort of eras that are going to get forgotten in time and aren't going to be preserved, which is always a concern when we obviously talk about, when we look at sort of films that we're losing, just even if we consider the films that we've lost in the crossover from VHS to DVD. There's still hundreds of titles that never made that transition, and it often worries me when we have these early films that, you know, are they going to be those ones that get lost to time?
Well, I think you're right, and these films, fortunately, certainly in China and in Taiwan, which we'll talk about in a second, there is a desire to preserve these. So you can occasionally catch these films at not quite film festivals, but quite often universities will do screenings and things like that. But you've got to be in the know to know that they're about. But definitely, I mean, this is a Japanese film, but Taiwan, especially at the moment, is uncovering a lot of films from the 30s, 40s and 50s, which are very different to the more well-known Taiwanese films, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that urge to preserve is certainly around, but I do feel that they're only available to academia, whether that's in film studies groups or language people and things like that. It's having those libraries available to people, to the rank and file, easily available. I don't know. I don't know what the interest is, but It's preservation is a concern.
Yeah, certainly when we're talking about in terms of how old films are appreciated, especially in terms of academia. I think that really kind of leads us very nicely onto number 79 on the list, which was obviously ran by Akira Kurosawa. Kurosawa, very important director in terms of Asian cinema. He's sort of up there with likes of Miyazaki. He's a director who would obviously go on to influence likes George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. Himself, he was influenced by the American cinema of John Ford to the extent that he wore sunglasses on his sets just to mimic how John Ford looked on his own set. So Ran is the first entry from Kurosawa.
Yeah, he gets on to dominate this list a little.
It's understandable. I mean, Kurosawa, I mean, for myself, I mean, coming up, getting into sort of Asian cinema, it was very much the case that you had sort of like Hong Kong sort of action movies and kung fu movies, and it was like Kurosawa. So it's sort of like you had the art house movies, and they all seemed to be like mainly Kurosawa movies. And then you had like all the stuff that was like, the Jackie Chan, the Bruce Lee, all the Golden Harvest, Shaw Bros, all that good stuff. Those were the two camps that you were sort of going back and forth between if you wanted to sort of like get into Asian cinema when I was sort of coming up. And the thing with Kurosawa is I always find that the academics really tend to make it seem like this, like, you know, very highbrow. This is, you know, you wouldn't understand. This is going to be too highbrow for you commoners to understand. And I've always found Kurosawa's movies very accessible. They're very beautiful to look at, and you can certainly look at them on that deeper level. But just on the surface level, they're very easy to watch. And certainly, Ran's a great pick. I'm a little surprised to see it at 79, but
yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously, it's based on King Lear, so it has a bit of a Western influence story-wise, and it's not the first time he adapted a Shakespeare story. Throne of Blood is Macbeth, for example. Yeah. But the memory for me of this film, actually, is back when it came out. Probably one of my first obvious memories of Asian cinema being a thing would have been on film, I don't know what years came out, film 94, film 95, 80, sorry. Film 84, film 85, where Barry Norman would have been talking about this film on his BBC film show, which was probably the only thing at that time. Obviously, I predate you a little, Elwood, but that was our gateway into film, was a half-hour show on the BBC late at night. And I do remember when Ran came out, it was a film he talked about in and amongst all the other films of the 80s, so it was probably one of the first times I was even aware of Japan being a place which produced epic cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Barry Norman. He was kind of like our Siskel and Ebert of the day, and unfortunately he felt that he was bigger than everyone else, and decided to go off to leave the BBC to work for Sky, and when that didn't take off, well, nobody gave a damn about Barry Norman anymore. And he was replaced by Jonathan Ross, who I think a lot of people sort of doubted at the time, and he really sort of showed his credentials. And I think in many ways that show led into like Moviedrome, which I would think certainly for ourselves, people who were interested in sort of more obscure cinema, was sort of like the more important movie show in turn. Obviously that paved the way for the likes of Ken Newman, Mark Kermode, a lot of the people I consider to be sort of mentors. But no, I think any time that Kurosawa work comes up that I haven't seen, it's always kind of exciting to see that. And his body of work is just really worth getting into. And I'm just surprised we haven't looked at it now. But
we might be changing that. Okay. 78 is a film which makes me angry. It's Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Also known as the movie that I've seen more people walk out of than any other movie.
Oh, they didn't see South Park, the movie, then. But yeah, I like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
That's good.
It's very well made. It's got a great cast. It's got some amazing visuals. And fantastic that it was a success as a subtitled period wuxia movie. What I hate about it is that for any of us that have been watching period subtitled wuxia movies, we'd seen it all before. And its place on this list makes me angry because it is, to my mind, a glossy version of other films which deserve to be here. And there are some names. So Ang Lee obviously is Taiwanese, but obviously he's channeling Chinese, Hong Kong, sort of new wave cinema in this. And there are names here like Choi Hark that just aren't on this list, whereas Ang Lee's on here for doing an homage to that sort of cinema. So that's why it makes me angry.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand what you're saying. I mean, there are certainly a lot of key movies that have been missed off this list, that certainly ones that we would include. I can certainly agree with yourself. There's certainly movies that are just as important, and these critics have missed them off. In terms of culturally, certainly Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was a very important movie, and just in terms of the films that followed. This was also one of the times that Tarantino was sort of flexing his sort of power and influence in the system, as he was the one who obviously made sure that it was brought across to the States, as he saw it at, I believe it was Cannes that he saw it. And when they brought it over to America, they were going to cut out the whole desert sequence, and he actually fought them just to keep it in its original format. And while we obviously know, when we look at Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, we know it, obviously, as we said already, because it led to the likes of Hero and House of Flying Daggers, it also opened the door to many of the Shaw Brothers movies coming across. And we also saw the release of Iron Monkey, the Donnie Yen movie, being brought across as a Tarantino production, just really on the back of the popularity and the revived interest in Hong Kong cinema. As no, for ourselves here in the UK, I would say that without Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon obviously showing the popularity still there for that film, we wouldn't have had labels such as like Hong Kong Legends reviving all the great sort of cinema that they obviously did. Just as a sort of fanboy, though, I mean, he's got Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh in the same movie, and it's Pride and Prejudice with swords. And there's just nothing that I really dislike about this movie. I understand where you're coming from, Stephen, and obviously the fact it's taking the place of other, perhaps more important films, but certainly culturally and
as a gateway film, I absolutely 100% agree with you. And I'd even go further. I think there's another film on this list that if we weren't open to subtitled cinema, might not have been as successful. And it'll surprise you which one I think it is, but it's in terms of the sort of the turn of the century change. It's not necessarily this film I have a problem with. It's the fact it's, there are other films that aren't on this list that are in this genre that are more authentic.
Yeah, I think just looking at some of the direct that we have on here, I mean, there's a lot of dead wood that you can cut out this movie, this list, and put better films in its place. But they seem to just be really going for sort of a lot of diversity. It's sort of like a lot of diversity, and the fact that they got to appease certain crowds by including a bunch of safe choices. And I'm just obviously like looking at some of these films, and it's sort of like, do I really want to watch this movie?
Yeah. Yeah, there is a bit of that, certainly in this sort of the lower half of this list. I think it does get a lot stronger, but still.
Okay.
Weird at times. Should we move on to number 72?
Yes, please.
Ikiru, by our friend Akira Kurosawa again. I haven't seen Ikiru. So, I don't know. This looks to be one of his more films set in the modern day.
Yep. I mean, this is a film that I've only recently discovered. So, this is thanks to Film 4 over here in the UK that I obviously discovered this one. Probably a film best known for the shot of the middle-aged salaryman sitting on the swing. That's been a favourite image whenever anyone talks about this movie. But the film itself is just a really nice film. I mean, it's the fact it's obviously Kurosawa working away from his sort of like traditional sort of samurai movies and that sort of thing, and actually doing something, I don't know with the word modern's the right way of describing it, but certainly the film is just absolutely beautiful. It's shot in black and white, and it's one of those films that I think when you watch it, it really does sort of stay with you. And I think it's definitely one worth checking out if you haven't already. If you haven't seen it already, then add another one to your cinema shame list.
Yeah, I there's another Akira Kurosawa film that's not on this list that I'd put on there above that, even though I haven't seen that one.
What, Runaway
that
Train?
Sound weird. No, High and Low.
Okay.
Which is a police procedural sort of thing. Based on an Ed McBain story, believe it or not. Kurosawa does pull from Shakespeare, Ed McBain, Tolstoy. He's he's kind of interesting because he does pull from these non-traditional inspirations, which might explain one of the fun things about this list, where the BBC said there were 7 Japanese critics and not one of them picked a Kurosawa film.
I think... I remember having this discussion with you before, and I think it's got a lot to do with, the fact that there's so many directors of our own sort of nationality we tend to ignore because we focus on foreign directors. And I feel that for a Japanese critic, they perhaps, because obviously Kurosawa is such an established force within Japanese cinema, that it may not sort of dawn on them to obviously reference him in the same way that, you know, that we wouldn't come to, like, say, a Spielberg movie, for example. We'd probably go with, if we were listening sort of contemporary directors, we would probably go for something like a Tarantino or Wes Anderson over like sort of Spielberg or George Lucas, one of like the new Hollywood sort of crowd. And I think that's sort of gone the way when it's come to these Japanese critics obviously giving their picks, that they've just sort of looked over the Kurosawa movies and focused on the world cinema that's obviously appealed to them instead.
I also wonder about when I speak to people, Asian people in their own country, they're not often very aware of their own country's cinema. They know about Western movies and Western movie stars and things like that. They are aware of their own stars, but it's not the same as... maybe China's a bit different, but certainly with the people I speak to in Hong Kong, they're interested in Western movies. Not many of them watch Hong Kong films, modern-day Hong Kong films. They might watch things from the Golden Age. So there is that, as you say, almost like the academic, the critical side of things is a little bit more transcontinental. Maybe something like that. Anyway, should we move on to number 71? Yeah. Which is the first of our Hong Kong entries. Well, all our Hong Kong entries are from the same director. I think. Yes. It's Wong Kar-wai's Happy Together, which is I don't know what to call queer cinema, I suppose.
It's new queer cinema. This one falls under because obviously the time period, this is 97. So it's coming up in that sort of branch, which obviously would include directors such like Greg Araki. You would also have... my man is just the worst today. and the likes of Gus Van Sant. These directors who were making... cinema about gay and lesbian relationships, but it wasn't like the focus is, oh my god, it's about the gay and a lesbian couple whichever they happen to be. It's just the fact that, you know, it's what they are.
They just happen to be gay, and here's a melodrama about them.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the whole basis to do queer cinema. It was sort of like, you know, we're not going to make films where the focus is, oh my god, it's shocking the fact they're gay. It's the fact, yes, these characters are gay, here's the story I'm telling you. And I think new queer cinema is, there's a lot of really good directors in there, and there's a lot of really great cinema in there as well. And when it comes to Wong Kar-wai, this is one of those directors I've, through the show, I've just sort of reevaluated my thoughts on, because before we obviously started doing this show, I think my first sort of reintroduction to it was when we did Chungking Express, which I think we'll be talking about a bit later in this list. And since then, I've re-evaluated my feelings on Wong Kar-wai, so I'm slowly working my way for the back catalogue. But I think Happy Together will be one that we will look at some point, certainly.
Yeah, I just imagine if we do this long enough, we'll cover all of Wong Kar-wai's filmography, because isn't as big as I thought it was. I was doing a bit of work on this tonight, and I thought, oh my god, he barely makes any films, does he? although he's involved with a lot more. So yeah, A fine film. It's not for me in even Wong Kar-wai's, but maybe it's in the top half of his 10 odd films he's made. Wouldn't make my top 100. Next up is number 68 is Ugetsu, by Kenji Mizoguchi, who's dominating the bottom half of the list. And even though I said I've never seen any of his films, I have. I've seen this one, and it's really good.
Yay!
I just did it while you were talking. I just double-checked. Oh, yes, I have seen this. Yeah, it's a period drama. It's black and white. It's in mono. It's beautiful. It's a, It's a bit of drama, a bit of fantasy. It's set in wartime. It's yeah, it's well worth watching. And you might even reckon you'll see this. It's very similar to things like Kwaidan, where they've got the women with the sort of the mascara eyebrows up high on their forehead, that kind of period era look. But it's a really beautiful. It's a really good film. It's artsy. Not, well, maybe artsy is the wrong word, but it's a 1950s Japanese drama.
Okay.
They are like this. So, well worth seeing. Is it worth placing this as? I don't know. Now, number 63 is a film from 1948. It's a Chinese film. Fei Mu's Spring in a Small Town. Now, this is one of those films I'm not sure would be on this list 10 years ago and will be on this list in 10 years' time. Have you seen it, Elwood?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. So it's a film, like I say, from 1948, which kind of got banned in China because, obviously, we're about to have the Cultural Revolution, and it wasn't a political film. It wasn't making any sort of... It's just a straight-up melodrama. And so it didn't make the approved films and kind of disappeared. Then a few years ago, it got like rediscovered, and the BFI have done like a DVD of it, and they do showings of it at film festivals and things like that. I have it on DVD. It's an absolute fine. It is really melodrama. It's a real melodrama, you know. It's nicely made. It's beautifully shot. I mean, it's not as spectacular as any of the other films we've talked about so far, and it almost feels like it's almost been a core celeb that's gained a little bit of purchase now, but I wonder if this list was done again in 10 years time anyone would even remember it. So yeah, weird one. So our old friend Kenji Mizoguchi back at number 61 with Sancho the Bailiff. I haven't seen, so I think we'll just skip past that. But clearly, I think our cinema shameless says we need to watch more Kenji Mizoguchi because we're obviously missing something.
Apparently so. I mean, just obviously before we obviously go into the next one, I mean, just obviously away from the Asian cinema, at 59, though, we have Come and See by Elim Kimoff, which is a really surprising title to see in there. That's a real ghoul cinema piece and a sort of film on World War II. As we go through the German countryside and to see horrible, horrible things. Yeah, Come and See is a really incredible war movie. It's certainly more about the horrors of war than a sort of like boy's own adventure. And if you like your war movies dark and gritty, then Come and See is definitely one to see. But I'm very surprised to see it on this list. I thought it would be way too sort of cult, much like Johnny Got His Gun, to obviously be appearing on a list like this, especially from the BBC.
I don't think the BBC had much choice in the matter. Yeah.
They hired these people. They just fudged it that they wanted.
So at number 56, there's a film we don't really need to talk about because you can go back to one of our earlier episodes and hear what we had to say about Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express. But you will know that it's one of my favourite films of all time, and I think Elwood, you came round to it because it was on your Cinema Shame list.
Yes, it was our first down into the Cinema Shame experience here on the show. Certainly a favourite of Quentin Tarantino. It was the launch title of his Rolling Thunder Pictures line, which was sadly short-lived. You can go on YouTube and see his little film school on Chungking Express, which is well worth checking out. But no, Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express is well worth checking out. The second story, I think, is better than the first story, but we obviously get to see the Asian Greta in a blonde wig, which is always nice.
Indeed it is. So excellent. Next up is a film I know that you've seen fairly recently. Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, Ang Lee again.
Food porn. This movie will make you want to just go and start cooking very elaborate meals. This is the opening sequence, which it sees this middle-aged chef who is losing his sense of taste, preparing this extremely elaborate lunch for his daughters. And just the voyeuristic way that Ang Lee positions his camera and watches this chef prepare food is like anything else that you've seen. I think only Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette has come this close to matching a film in terms of food porn. But Eat, Drink, Man, Woman is a recent discovery for myself, and one much like The Wedding Banquet, which Ang Lee also directed. I think it's one of more hidden films on his filmography, and one worth checking out, definitely.
Yeah, and his sort of initial Taiwanese career. So there's a good selection of films there. So I don't have a problem with the Drink Man Woman. Next up is a name which we will hear again. If you were to hold a gun to my head blindfolded and ask me to guess any of the films on the list, this would be in one of the 10 films I'd have chosen, just because it's that kind of list. So it's Late Spring by Yasujiro Ozu. Ozu is one of those directors that all film directors love. His films, Late Spring and another one which I won't mention, are always at the top of film directors' own favourite films. To me, they're kitchen sink dramas from the 60s that are interestingly filmed. So he's got a sort of unique style. They're kind of important because of how they reflect on modern Japanese life and maybe the decay of it. But it's just one of those obvious film critic choices to me. At 41 is another Zhang Yimou film, To Live. I don't know that film. It just makes me even more surprised that Hero wasn't on here, if To Live can get to 41. At 38, we have A Brighter Summer Day by Edward Yang. Now, I love Edward Yang. I love Taiwanese New Wave cinema. So there's a few of them coming up. I don't know if you've seen any, Elwood, but Brighter Summer Day is a Taiwanese drama set in the 60s, sort of during the Kuomintang takeover of Taiwan. It's a bit like West Side Story without any singing. So it's about school kids and violence and crime and family, and all under the auspices of a basically a military coup. It's brilliant, but it's 3 hours of your life. And this is coming from me, Mr. 90-minute film man. I do love Edward Yang. I do love Taiwanese New Wave cinema, but that's a very specific thing to like. So I probably won't be bringing it up on the podcast. Now, next up is the film I was hinting at earlier, a film that has possibly was assisted by Crouching Tiger success. It's the only animated film on this list. It's the only Hayao Miyazaki film on this list. It's not my favourite Ghibli film. It's not my favourite Miyazaki film. But I can understand why it's here, because it's clearly internationally the most popular, and that's Spirited Away.
Yeah, Spirited Away is another gateway movie, certainly. I think this is the one which obviously brought Ghibli to the attentions of a lot of people, and it also earned Miyazaki that horrible moniker of Disney of the East, which he absolutely openly hates, and I understand why, because he's not making Disney movies. I think, if anything, if we were obviously comparing to American animator, I think he's making more Don Bluth-style movies than he is anything close to a Disney movie. Yeah, Spirited Away is a really wonderful movie. I absolutely adore it. But when we're obviously looking at the Miyazaki back catalogue, if we're looking at the Studio Ghibli catalogue, there's just other films on there which I would have put well above this. Certainly Princess Mononoke would be the, like, my number one with a bullet, followed by Kiki's Delivery Service. Both omitted for the list. I don't understand why they obviously... I think the only way I can see them going with Spirited Away is the fact that obviously... It was a gateway movie for Ghibli movies, and the fact that it obviously got a lot of Oscar attention as well. And it sort of opened this doorway, which is still now open for Ghibli movies to come through, and led to the likes of Howl's Moving Castle getting the sort of attention that they probably would have not otherwise received, especially being, you know, an anime movie. But yeah, Spirited Away is well worth checking out. It's, you know, it's fun.
It's for me, it's great. It's in my top three, but it's no Totoro. So there we go. I'm glad there's an animated movie on here. I'm glad that it's recognised. It's probably the first film we've talked about so far that would have had, maybe other than Crouching Tiger, that would have really had a resonance amongst people that weren't film critics.
Yeah, I feel it's very shocking the fact that we're at 37 and this is the first animated movie that we've seen. It's even more shocking when we look at the list ahead. And I'm just going to obviously go and say just spoiler that now that these films aren't on the list and Akira is nowhere on this list, the most important Japanese animation of all time, and a film that obviously being made in 88 is still considered the benchmark for all animation. And it's nowhere on this list. It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, I would also ask where Ghost in the Shell is. Perhaps a little more of an outside choice. especially because of, if we compare it to like Light of Akira. But again, it's still an important piece and still missing from this list. And the question asks, why? Why are we cramming this list full of art out, Tosh, if we're missing out important cultural pieces such as Akira and Ghost in the Shell? Certainly these were films which obviously made us reevaluate the animated form, that it was no longer just something for kids and perverts. It could be used to tell intelligent and thoughtful stories and at the same time be done in with such incredible levels of detail and artistry that you would compare it to even like the most well-crafted of Oscar pictures. But, you know, obviously these critics felt differently. But what the hell do they know?
Oh dear. Very, very impassioned speech there in defence of animated cinema. But I have to agree. I mean, the list as a whole, I don't think there are any other animated films on the list as a whole. Maybe I can't think of too many that is easy to squeeze out if you're only picking 100. It's a funny one. Now, at 29, we have what I think is the only sort of genre film on the list. It's the only film from South Korea, which I find absolutely shocking. And it's Park Chan-wook's Old Boy. Don't get me wrong, Park Chan-wook's Old Boy is a fantastic film. And it's a film, once you've seen it, will stay with you forever. But for me, Old Boy isn't even Park Chan-wook's best movie. let alone the best South Korean movie, allegedly, of all time.
Yeah, again, this is another gateway movie. Park Chan-wook's Vengeance trilogy is an absolute masterwork, and I agree, it's not the best of the trilogy. Lady Vengeance is clearly the best of the trilogy. Again, even just looking at Park Chan-wook's filmography, there are other films on here which have sorely omitted from this list. Removing the Vengeance trilogy, if we look at films such as Joint Security Area, I would have expected to see that perhaps up in the 90s, but I'm questioning why that wasn't on the list, especially because Park Chan-wook was obviously such a key part in sort of kicking open the door to Korean cinema coming across. I think this, alongside Brotherhood, was sort of like the films which made us realise, you know, Korea is actually making some really important cinema. Old Boy is the film that's got a lot of crossover appeal, so I can understand why it's on this list. There's a lot of people out there who don't like subtitled movies who like Old Boy. In the same way, it makes you question why Battle Royale wasn't on this list when it also serves the same purpose. Are we to assume that critics can't stand the idea of having two sort of gory, violent pictures on the list of very sort of art house movies? Do they feel that it would somehow sully the films? I mean, I don't understand. I mean, the fact Battle Royale can be missing from this film, perhaps one of like the most important films, along with like The Ring, certainly in terms of the revival of interest in Asian cinema. I mean, the whole Asian cinema revival can be pinned down to the likes of The Ring and Audition and Battle Royale. Again, all three films missing from this list, and I don't think we would have half the range of Asian cinema that we have now had it not been for those films obviously getting picked up and making people go question, you know, what have I not been watching Asian cinema? Why have I been distracted by these other things? But again, it's one of the frustrating aspects of this list, and I think I'm just kind of glad that Old Boy did get a mention just for cultural significance and just so we can obviously have this rant now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to rant further, because even if we're just talking about contemporaries of Park Chan-wook, right, I can think of a number of directors that make films as good as, if not better. You have, what's his name? Bong Joon-ho, who would be famous for Memories of Murder, which to me is the greatest South Korean film of modern times, and The Host, Mother, and of course Snowpiercer, and Okja, if you want.
Yeah, Snowpiercer. When's that coming to the UK?
Yeah, I knew I was going to trigger you on that one. I would suggest Kim Ji-woon, director of Tale of Two Sisters, Bittersweet Life, Good, the Bad, the Weird, I Saw the Devil. I mean, he's gone off the board a little bit since then, but you know, those films, any one of those films could have appeared in this list. And then if we're going to say, well, actually a lot of these people are quite art housey, I would say Kim Ki-duk. I'm surprised none of his films have been in it. I mean, I'm not, other than Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter and Spring and Three Iron, most of his films I find to be a little tiresome, but he's certainly a director who I would have thought would have appealed to this particular audience, as is Hong Sang-soo, who has made loads of films that always seem to get on critics' best of lists, but there's so I've talked about one in one of my Dark Tales, The Virgin Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors, but he's got a great long storied sort of indie art house career that I thought would have appealed there. So that's just off the top of my head without really thinking about it. I'm shocked that that's the only South Korean film. Rant over. Number 25. It's Edward Yang again. This is Yi Yi, which was his last film he made before he died. Really good, but I know that Elwood won't have seen it.
Nope.
But again, it's another 3-hour epic, guys, but it is one of the best films ever from Taiwan. The next one, number 18, is A City of Sadness, and I'm not going to say this guy's name right, not that I've been saying anyone's name right so far this evening, but Hu Hsiao-hsien, another one of the new wave Taiwanese directors. City of Sadness I've seen, Tony Leung's in it, funnily enough, although he couldn't speak Mandarin, so he has to be mute in the whole film. It's another 3-hour job. Really good. Actually, what I was a bit surprised about is, you know, usually when you get these lists, where someone says, oh, the best 100 films of the year, not of the year, of the last 100 years, when it's not foreign, you always get one that's really contemporary. You know, like they'll do it, oh yeah, I really liked Avengers Infinity War. We'll appear at number 6, and you think, what? and then the next year it won't be on the list at all, because you always have. And I was surprised, if they were going to pick a Hu Hsiao-hsien film, I was surprised they don't pick Assassin, the Assassin from a couple of years ago, which got loads of love from high level critics, and I frigging adored it, but most people I know thought it utterly impenetrable and pretentious tosh, but I like a bit pretentious tosh. So interesting director, film critic darling. I'm just surprised it was that one and not The Assassin. Next, at number 12, so we're just hitting the top 10, is Chinese film, Chen Cage's Farewell My Concubine, which I guess also had a bit of crossover. I certainly knew about this before at the time. Leslie Cheung, who's going to be a future subject of Dark Tales, just keep pimping that for you. Really great film, great performance, beautiful look. Chen Cage is probably the foremost mainland director,
yeah,
currently going, I would have said. Is that fair to say?
This is a fifth wave movie. I mean, it's one that obviously, again, it's that sort of, when we say like fifth wave, it was sort of this interest in Asian cinema in particular, but in this case, Chinese cinema. The film itself, I mean, Miramax picked it up and butchered the hell out of it. But Roger Ebert did actually champion this one. He was a big fan of this one. And it was one of those ones I remember coming through, I think it was Artificial Eye. So this was one of the more art house sort of ones that you could pick up on VHS back in the day. And you sort of like picked it up, first of all, because it was released through Artificial Eye, which sort of gave you a hint that it may be actually worth watching for an art house movie. And second, because there wasn't a huge amount else of Hong Kong cinema being coming out. But yeah, Farewell My Concubine is really, really nice.
Yeah, so, and I think it may be on my list for a future choice. So I won't say too much about it. Into the top 10 now. We've got 4 films left. Number 9 is Wong Kar-wai again, who I think had 3 films on this list.
He's certainly a popular one. But then again, so much of this list, it just feels like they're playing it safe. So, but
In the Mood for Love. Year 2000, In the Mood for Love. One of the most beautiful things ever put to film.
Yep.
Again, a film we'll talk about again. I have no complaints with In the Mood for Love. It's, you know, as much as I love Chungking Express, I love In the Mood for Love even more. And if, you know, you don't fall in love with Maggie Cheung and Creepo dresses, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, I think there's two types of people in this world. People who have seen In the Mood for Love and people who have clearly not lived because they've not seen In the Mood for Love. Yeah, it's a romantic drama, but don't let that put you off. It's obviously got Tony Leung, Maggie Cheung heading it up as these two people brought together because their spouses have been having an affair, and over the course of the film, they slowly develop feelings for each other. It's just so beautiful to look at. It's wonderful. I really, really like In the Mood for Love.
It looks beautiful. It sounds beautiful. It's just, it's, you know, if I want to show somebody a real Asian cinema classic, this is the one I'd pull out. Okay, so that's number 9. Don't get another Asian film now to number 4. Number 4, I think, is both obvious and deserved, is Rashomon by, Akira Kurosawa.
yeah.
But it's a film which is fine. No, it's more than fine. It's really good. But I think its structure, it's almost become an adjective for its own structure. So other films that use a similar structure are always called Rashomon-like, yeah?
Very much so. Rashomon is very much a safe choice. If someone's going to go with a Kurosawa movie, it'll be this or the other film that features on this list. Not to give away the surprise there. but I think you probably all know what it is if we talk about Kurosawa and we haven't mentioned it. Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised at Rashomon. I say surprised. I think I was more surprised at the fact that Keiji Musha, the Shadow Warrior, wasn't included on this list. Especially because Keiji Musha, I mean, was a film that was executive produced by both George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. So the guys who pretty much built their style and career off Kurosawa giving something back to the master, and it doesn't get a mention on this list, and it's absolutely, it just astounds me. It was but you know, what do they know, clearly?
Well, we're glad to know our exasperation is nearly at an end. We've only got 2 left. Number 3 is the film I thought would be at number 1, because it's always at number 1 in director polls and Sight of Sam polls, and it's Tokyo Story by Yasujirō Ozu again. So it's the second Ozu film. Yeah, it's a really good film. It's clearly a director's favourite, clearly a critic's favourite. But to me, it's kitchen sink drama from the 50s. It's well made. It doesn't move me like a film, the third best foreign language film of all time, should do. And at number 1, the anticipation is punctured, because we all know it's going to be Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa.
Of course.
Any complaints?
Well, apart from the fact this is a film you've got to dedicate like 3 hours of your life to, but I mean, how can you...
There's quite a lot of that on this list.
Yeah, how can you... Seven Samurai is an absolute masterwork. It's one of the films I remember watching with my dad. I mean, he taught this movie up, and I remember watching it, not even knowing who Kurosawa was. I had no sort of concept of like the importance of this movie. I was just like, you know, it's samurai, they're going to be kicking a load of bandits' ass. And this group of samurai is just so colourful and unique. In the sort of setup, it's just a wonderful, wonderful film, and it's also a film which would be remade. It got sort of like a steampunk sort of remaking as Samurai 7, which is a really cool anime series, which gives it sort of like a futuristic mecha twist on it, and you know, perhaps downplays the masterpiece that is Kurosawa's film. But yeah, I don't know. How can you really dislike Seven Samurai apart from the fact it's so bloody long?
I don't think so. And of course, it also got remade as another film in the West. I have no complaints with. I have no complaints of any of the ones that are placed in the top 10.
Yeah,
I might not get Tokyo Story, but I understand why people rate it.
Well,
but I have two broad complaints with the whole list. One is the lack of genre films. I don't know that. So there's Old Boy, and maybe we can include Spirited Away as a more family friendly fare. They are the only two Asian films on that list which I would call genre films. And actually this feeds into it, there is one film from the 1980s and no films from the 1960s. And actually, Hong Kong cinema's greatest moments were the 80s and early 90s. But apparently only Wong Kar-wai's working in Hong Kong. So all that energy and their new wave, Choi Hark and others, look like no one's even been alive to watch those films. And the 60s, again, was an incredibly fertile time, especially in Japanese cinema. And it's just completely ignored. And I just thought that was... I'm not even sure there's many from the 70s either, actually. No, there's none from the 1970s either. So basically, it looks like Asian cinema stopped in about 1955 and didn't start again till 1990, which is not true. So there's something about the ages of the critics or something like that. It's quite striking.
Just tell the truth. They're a bunch of toffs. They're just sitting there and they stroke their beards and click their tongues and turn their nose up at hardworking underdogs like ourselves who champion genre cinema and can appreciate the fact that not everything has to drag on for 3 hours and have like 40 different mood lighting moments, and the fact that something can just be funny and violent and feature like excess and features like Tosu Mufune or be directed by Shinzen Suzuki and have like movies where hitmen move in with each other and form like odd couple relationships like in Branded to Kill. But no, we just have to have like gateway movies or established art house movies. This list annoyed me something rotten when I saw it. I think if we were to sit down and do like our 50, then we would probably come up with a very different list. I think some of these titles, like a lot of the Wong Kar-wai would be on there, and obviously the Kurosawa films would probably be on there as well. But I think we would end up with a very different sort of list if we were obviously picking the films.
I mean, I think I was thinking that. I thought if we both did our 25 would be completely different. Not only from that, but from each other. But I suspect chunking it, I don't know. There might be, like you say, a Wong Kar-wai film might make it, a Kurosawa film might make it to both our lists, but it might not be the same ones. These are none of the films that I have seen that are on this list are bad films. But are they the films that make me? Are these the films that make me enjoy cinema?
This is the line. This is where the line between academia and enjoying and cinema enjoyment come. Because a lot of these films they're picked for their academia and their importance to cinema. It's sort of like the reason that this list is crammed with so much French New Wave, which can just be cut
they're
straight off.
They're film studies, film school films, aren't they?
They're films that people feel that you have to watch, like a lot of the things on the 1001 Movies to See Before You Die list. And the fact is that you don't need to see some of these movies. You can have a very rich and fulfilling experience as a viewer of Asian cinema and not watch these films. And I think stay tuned, kids, to next year, because we will be bringing you our 50. We're clearly we've got to go and take our belt off and show some critics how you actually put together a list of Asian cinema, because just to have a list of gateway titles and art house favourites is missing so much out. And I think we've sort of established this on the list when we've also gone off titles that weren't on the list, that there's a lot of people certainly class writers, critics there who would be given titles. And I think if you were, if you didn't know anything about Asian cinema and you looked at this list and think, okay, this is going to be my guiding point, these are going to be the films I'm going to check out, I'm going to use this as my gateway into Asian cinema, I think you would come away very bored and you probably wouldn't look at Asian cinema again. I think all of these films would just leave you a very, very dry. And it's a shame, really, because obviously, as we've established on this show, there's just such a wide variety of colourful and unique and interesting films within Asian cinema. And it's just unfortunate the fact that we have a lot of critics who constantly push the very dry and humdrum sort of titles and just ignore things because, you know, they're fun, or perhaps they're not as, they haven't got the sort of the same artistic flair or the as intelligent written as like a Kurosawa movie, but it doesn't mean that they don't have the same sort of cultural significance. And I think this is something that we've always strived to emphasize on the show, you know, the fact that it doesn't have to be a film that's critically acclaimed to still have significant importance.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'd go back to one of our first episodes, maybe our second episode. You maybe watched King Kong versus Godzilla.
No, King Kong. King Kong Escapes.
King Kong Escapes. That's what I did. Watch the other one as well. Right. Now that film, on the face of it, wouldn't make anyone's top 100 list, right?
But they'd be wrong. But
it was. It was. So much. I mean, I think you were scared about me watching it, weren't you?
I'm always scared when it comes to kaiju movies, because kaiju movies, I mean, it's a guy in a rubber suit just stomping on Tokyo.
But it was a load of fun, and I bought into it, and it was hugely enjoyable, enough for me to go and give it to someone else to watch, you know? And I think if you're too dry about cinema, you're not enjoying it. And I probably like more of these films on this list than you. I think that's probably fair to say. But there is, one or two aside, there's a lack of fun and enjoyment on there. And I don't want to be miserable all the time. I can do a good line in miserable, don't get me wrong. But I need the full gamut of emotions from my cinema. And whilst some emotions are aroused by these films, it's not the full gamut of them, and therefore I find the list limited. And if we look at the list in a wider context, it's not too far different for everything else, is it? Like you said, there's a lot of French New Wave on there.
you can live a full and rich life not watching Godard. I will tell you that now.
indeed. And we, you know, we watch horror movies, we watch comedy. I mean, there's not even a comedy on here.
Yes, there are. I mean, again, we're talking about gateway movies. There's not a Stephen Chow movie on there. Like, I mean, Shaolin Soccer, yes, I guess perhaps would be a little lowbrow, but like Kung Fu Hustle, I would have expected to have been on there. I mean, that film had a huge sort of impact, especially with Western audiences. And I think, again, that was off the back of Shaolin Soccer. Stephen Chow,
and it was, and he's a huge deal in the East. And there were, these weren't, let's just make this point clear, these critics were not British or American or Western, they were international critics. You know, so we're not just talking about people who were in dusty old university somewhere, you know, we're talking about dusty old universities all over the world. No, just the old newsrooms. And I do get it. When your job is reviewing films, you will get jaded. And you will start looking for maybe more technical things or subtle things. I don't know. But my God, it's just lack of fun. A lack of fun. But I take your challenge. I suggest we both get our 25 list over the next 12 months. And we'll do another one of these, or another couple of these, where we give our lists, yeah?
Yep. We will be, in the new year, we will be coming to you with our 50. So that will be 25 for myself, 25 from Stephen, and we will be running down our 50 in the new year, so definitely look forward to that. And, yeah, I think it's safe to say our list will be better. It will not make you want to kill yourself.
Mine is to be better than yours.
So I think, well, this brings us to the end of this bonus episode. We hope you've enjoyed our our thoughts on this list produced by the BBC. We did put the full list up on the Facebook page, so you can check it out there and, you know, let us know your thoughts. Are we being too harsh? Are we being unappreciated of culture? Let us know in the comment section there. You can always, as always, follow us on both Spotify, on iTunes, Podomatic. You can also get all our episodes through the for our podcast network at thatmomentin.com, as well as checking out our blog. Check our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, and on there you can not only find all the archive episodes, you can find all the fun bits of writing we do on there as well, including transcripts of Stephen's Dark Side of Asian Cinema as well. But thank you as always for listening. Thank you, of course, to my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Thank you very much, Sherwood.
And we'll be back next time with the winner of our poll for Kaiju Christmas. So we will obviously be back with Gamera and finding out who he's going to be fighting. So if you haven't done already, definitely get on vote off on the blog and let us know who you would like to see Gamera fighting for Kaiju Christmas this year. But until next time, good night.
昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ